Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
The first thing Hannah noticed this evening upon coming over to our studio is our lack of alcohol. And that's because I'm still recovering from Halloween.
Yeah, where's the chocolate then?
That's why I'm recovering.
Okay.
The so absence of chocolate.
You didn't save any for me. Okay, fine.
I'm sure you could steal some from the kid. He wouldn't even know.
Exactly. I'm sure I can.
There's a lot, I believe, opening in theaters this week, and one big one on Netflix. Oscar buzz for some of them, Oscar buzz for not all of them.
You think?
Let's start with what will most likely be the biggest film this week. Terminator, Dark Fate. I'm already off-put before I even walk into it, because they're erasing films. The purpose of Terminator, Dark Fate is to pretend like the last three Terminator films never happened. That means 2003's Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, Terminator Salvation, Terminator Genesis, they don't exist. Halloween franchise has done this. Jurassic Park franchise has done this. They create a sequel, and it's a sequel for a film that happened way long time ago. And it skips and pretends other sequels that you may or may not have seen never happened. Dark Fate is a direct sequel to the 1991 T2 Judgment Day, the most famous, the most box office successful, the most well-liked, the most well-preserved Terminator film of them all. Linda Hamilton, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I still give the edge to the original, the Terminator from 1984.
And they haven't erased that film yet.
No,
technically, that film still exists.
Well, because this is the sequel. Judgment Day was the sequel to the Terminator. And then this one is the sequel to Judgment Day.
Even though the one in 2003 was the sequel to Judgment Day. Like, that happened. I will never forget.
I didn't see it, so if I didn't see it, it doesn't exist.
Hashtag never forget. That happened. Dark Fate, same premise. People come back from the future to protect people in the present. This time, one good, one bad. We've seen that before. Happens all the time in these Terminator films.
That's why they exist.
Same plot, really. This time, once again, the bad guy is an even better version of the previous bad guy. Remember, T-1000 Robert Patrick came back, and he can just kind of melt through bars and walls and get shot and put himself back together. Now it's the Rev-9, and he's even better. He can just attach himself to other metal objects. He can split himself off from his skeleton and become two fighting machines at the same time. This guy's gonna be tough. I don't know how they're gonna beat this guy. But the one coming back this time is girl power.
Absolutely.
Grace, played by Mackenzie Davis, she's human. She's human, but she's augmented. She calls herself, I'm a super soldier. And she's coming back to protect, not Linda Hamilton, she's coming back to protect Danny, played by Natalia Reyes. In your opinion, how is Grace versus Rev-9? How is this very overly familiar yet somewhat new plot for you?
Well, but you're leaving out a critical girl power
factor.
I'm bringing it there because the trio of Linda Hamilton's character, Sarah Connor, returning in this film, it's three against this one evil splitting form splitting creature thing. So Rev-9, and so I do think it's that the mix of the three women really just make this a very, a different kind of Terminator. Even though the story is generally the same, there is this feeling that it really is updated for our modern times.
Well, Linda Hamilton has always held her own.
Yeah.
Even in the first one, she held her own. But now she's pure offense. There's no defense now. She has one of the best action movie entrances I think I've ever seen in my life.
It's awesome.
People are about to die, and all of a sudden Linda Hamilton just steps up with a bazooka and just
she's just war-weary in her veins. Yeah, she's just this war-weary looking, gravelly-voiced woman from, who really has just been, along with Arnold Schwarzenegger, the common thread in these films. But in terms of your question about the two new characters, Danny and Grace, they actually, to me, what they represent that next generation of this film, that potential for the continuation of the Terminator franchise. And I have no problem with the fact that they reset because I had not seen a single Terminator film until last week. And when I read, And so I had to play massive catch up. But I only decided to play catch up when I read that this was a direct sequel to T2. So as long as you can rewatch or have seen The Terminator and Judgment Day, then this one, you know, it was so fresh in my mind from just having seen those first two that I think I maybe got a lot more out of this third one than someone who was kind of coming in having been having their minds, you know, muddled by those other three that just kind of were are meant to be forgotten, something about taking place in alternate timelines or something. But there was also the TV series, the Sarah Connor's Chronicles, and so Sarah Connor Chronicles. So, you know, all that stuff you're expected to just dismiss. And so I think I actually enjoyed this one more than you did for the girl power and for the just for that sheer continuity of having just seen T1 and T2.
I didn't like it not because of the girl power. I actually admired what they did there. And I've seen all the films. And yes, Terminator Genisys is garbage. Salvation wasn't that bad. Christian Bale was in it. He was just fine. But from what I remember from Rise of the Machines, they're so jumbled together and forgettable, especially those middle ones. And this one, I think it's just pure forgetfulness. Like they said it last time, and they said it again. This one's going to start a new trilogy. Sure, it is. The box office will determine that.
And I think the box office will determine that, and I think the determination will be that they will pull the trigger on more.
Actually, I don't know. This one might actually make less than Genisys.
It could, but I think it will do well enough that when you look at it as sort of that opportunity to just put these fresh faces front and center. I think they're likable enough, and I just think that we don't have that many really good female-driven action-adventure films, and
Laura Croft.
My goodness, that's going.
Charlize Theron and Mad Max Fury Road. I mean, if you had given me time to prepare that list, I could have prepared that list.
But I think that, you know, most people automatically, their minds tend to go, certainly mine does, to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Dora the Explorer.
I miss that one. But I just, it's not, you know, I don't think you have to see it if you aren't already.
No, it's for completists.
It's totally for completists, but it's also for completing the one chapter. But I do think that it sets the stage for the next. And so if you enjoy that kind of franchise, if you enjoy that sci-fi time travel sort of thing, action adventure sci-fi flick, then in order to have your baseline for the potential of future installments of this franchise, then you need to see this one. And there's the continuity factor of James Cameron being back in the mix for
only as producer. He actually didn't have a creative input.
He did. He has a story by credit.
Well, there were three screenwriters and five story bys.
But I think he was.
So he gets 20% of the story by.
But the rights reverted back to him. And I think he did have enough of a creative role behind the scenes in this one to provide that continuity from one and two, whereas he was not involved at all in the ones you mentioned that kind of came in the middle there.
The whole existence of Dark Fate, it just annoys me. It's so cynical. The tagline should be, do you remember how awesome you felt in 1991 with Arnold versus Linda? Feel that way again. Here's Arnold and Linda again. Remember how awesome 91? Didn't you feel better in 91 than 19? Feel that way again. And they had to erase three films to make this happen. It just annoys me.
It annoys you, but I think that the majority, I think you're in the minority with the annoyance factor. I think a lot of people have appreciated that nostalgia factor. It was fun to see the interactions between Arnold Schwarzenegger and Linda Hamilton again. And, you know, because their dynamic has been slightly different, was slightly different in those first two films. And so and Arnold makes a great, you know, his entrance into this film is really fun, too. And so I love that this movie doesn't take itself too seriously, except when it kind of needs to drive the narrative, because there are some serious issues actually kind of played out
There's the U.S.-Mexico border. Mm-hmm. There's some great one-liners.
There are
especially
some,
one takes place there about prisoners versus detainees.
Right.
And there's one that just skips a whole fake technology dialogue about what are you doing, and she just says future stuff.
Right.
Oh, she didn't say stuff, but
she said something other than stuff.
It's genius and lazy at the same time.
It is, and it works for that. To me, it's a very serviceable sequel. And I don't think that, it's not a must-see. It's not going to win any major awards except for potentially, some in the special effects.
Not even close.
We'll see. It could sneak in there with some special effects stuff. I just disagree with you. I saw the people around me enjoyed it way more than you did. I liked it. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of that franchise, having really just...
Well, yeah, you just saw the first two
just
last week.
Just having finally seen them.
You have no long-term scope on this.
I didn't. But my scope, I think, is better than yours for this particular viewing, because my scope was limited to watching 1, 2, and what they now like to consider 3.
I saw T2 when I was 12. It made an impact. And it's just... They want me to feel that way again. And that's just so cloying.
I don't think so. I feel that they want you to feel a nostalgia factor plus something new. And
there's nothing new about this.
There is something new about it. And you get the newness with
it's the same plot
the new players.
As the other five.
That's how these franchise sequels always work. The plot is generally somewhat similar.
Somewhat.
It is what it is. But it is introducing... the potential for these other for going in a slightly different direction and maybe generating some new plots.
Really? I bet the next one will have someone coming back too.
I don't know, maybe they'll really turn things around and sort of make it so that somebody comes, from the past. Wouldn't that be cool?
Whoa, mind blown. Mind totally blown. All right. We're going to disagree on that one.
Okay.
Our next film is an adaptation. And a long gestating adaptation. You know him as actor Edward Norton, Big Break 1996, Primal Fear, and he read a book in 99 called Motherless Brooklyn by Jonathan Lethem, and ever since he's been trying to make that movie, and he said he cashed in every favor he ever had in Hollywood. So he said, if in the next 10 years you see me in some movies you think are beneath me, this is why. I owe everybody in Hollywood now. Warner Brothers said, okay, come make your neo-noir movie based on this relatively popular novel. I read the novel. I think it was in 2007. And honestly, Hannah, even though I'm holding it in my hands right now because I found it on my bookshelf, I don't remember a thing about it.
Well, and it's really funny because I'm looking at the book, and based on the film and the length of the film, I am shocked to see how short the book looks.
Well, it is a very long. Well, it's 144 minutes. And it looks, and he changed, I don't think there's a lot of similarities. The book takes place in the 90s. The movie takes place in the 50s. It's still a mystery. It's kind of a whodunit, a whydunit, who's the bad, what's the bad guy's motivation, that sort of thing. But I think everything else is new from the very few strains I can remember. What I do want to say is I believe the name Lionel Esrog is one of my favorite character names all year.
And, I actually knew a family named Esrog, so it was very funny to me to even hear that.
Did the mystery, did the noir, did the gumshoe, did that special gumshoe language, did it do it for you?
It was very much when the narration begins and you get into this film, it's very much like, and then there was this dame.
The dame. I should have known she was trouble
exactly.
As soon as she walked in.
I mean, you feel that from the get-go. This was one of those films that I can't really put my finger on why it's not better than it is, but I wasn't completely disappointed in it because I didn't feel like it was a waste of time to see it, but it almost was, had just the ensemble cast in addition. So Edward Norton is amazing, is great. He plays this, private detective who's trying to figure out who killed his mentor, boss, best friend, played by Bruce Willis.
Frankie DeFranco.
And so then the thing with Lionel Esrog's character is he's got Tourette syndrome. And so this is a unique twist on what is otherwise feels like a pretty conventional gumshoe noir crime drama. But as I was sort of going off on before, the cast of supporting characters is really strong, but they don't have enough to do, and you don't really feel like you get to know them well enough. And so to me, that was probably one of the bigger disappointments, because you've got Alec Baldwin as like this sleazy politician who sort of will remind you of his current portrayal of a certain president on Saturday Night Live. Gugu Mbatha-Raw, she's had quite the year. She's very good. Willem Dafoe, Bobby Cannavale, Leslie Mann, Terry Jones. I mean, this is a really rock solid cast. But I just didn't feel that they got their due enough to really make this film just sort of break free into something special. And at nearly 2.5 hours, you know, it felt pretty darn slow.
I think I liked it a little bit better than you did. The reason those supporting characters may not get their due, there's a lot of plot. In fact, I think there's too much plot.
Yes.
There's 3.5 too many twists. Mm-hmm. There's 5 too many loose ends to tie up. And we know the villain. He's actually based on a real life villain. We saw a documentary about him. The real life guy was Robert Moses. He was in that documentary, Citizen Jane, Battle for the City. You had Jane Jacobs in Manhattan protesting against the freeway that Moses wanted to build across the center of Manhattan, just like he did up in the Bronx, and it would have destroyed the city.
Yeah.
And she led the fight against him and his,
oh, right.
You know, in this film, they call it the borough authority, and his, you know, where does he get all his power from? He's not elected. No one voted for this guy. And that's who Alec Baldwin is playing, is that guy.
Yeah, Moses Randolph's character. And it's, I mean, it really is, I liked it, but you're right. There was too much plot. I even noted that, you know, it was, there was too much to absorb when you've got subplots involving, you have political corruption, abuse of power, urban housing issues, family dynamics, murder, intrigue. Plus, on top of that, you've got some romance with Lionel and Gugu and Mbatha-Raw's character. And so it's a lot. And I do think that in the end, that sort of detracted from the movie. But, you know, hey, I did learn, did you know where Edward Norton is from?
I'm going to guess Maryland, since you're setting it up.
Up the road in Columbia, Maryland. And his grandfather was Rouse, the one who actually developed Columbia, Maryland, and is sort of considered the founder, pioneer of shopping malls.
Yeah, Columbia is actually known as like the ultimate planned mm-hmm. community.
Yeah, and so that's where he's from, and he's got family ties like that run really deep. So, you know, so I think that's part of where his passion for this project came from. And, you know, who can fault him? You know, you get this stuff under your skin, and you want to be able to make it, and he got to make it. And I think it's one of those films that'll be fine if you're just sitting on a plane, or if you're not a Terminator buff and you want something that's a lot slower paced and kind of gumshoe throwback to a, it really feels like a throwback movie to a 50s drama.
I have a soft spot for film noir. I love everything about it. I love the fedoras. I love that everybody smokes all the time. I love that the streets are always wet because it always just rained. And everyone has this monologue about what they're doing and how they don't trust anybody. It just, that film genre works for me. I love everything about it. Bogart, you know, he's Bogart with Tourette's. It works. I'm already walking in just predisposed to enjoy this type of film. I don't love it. I will stick to my guns. It has way too much plot. The script needed a tighter re-edit. His passion project had too much passion.
Yeah.
He wrote it. He directed it. But he needed a stronger editor to push him a little bit more.
So ultimately, I think we actually do agree on this one, just for slightly different reasons.
And if I had to nominate for something, it would be for production design.
Absolutely. The gorgeous, cinematography. Gorgeous, I mean, production. It absolutely makes you really feel like you were driving along the streets of New York
and Omar 1950s. From The Wire shows up, too, in a pretty good but small role.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you like sort of like those, whenever they would do like those old Magnum PI episodes where they would sort of go back in time, like sort of flashback to things in black and white, that's what this reminded me of.
All right. Netflix movie alert. Last week, Hannah told us all about Dolomite Is My Name. I caught up with that this week. She was right. It's a great film. Eddie Murphy, Wesley Snipes. I loved everything about Dolomite. I caught up with, it's now on Netflix today, The King, starring ya boy.
I love Timothy Chalamet.
Timothy Chalamet. He's brave. He's taking on Henry the Fifth. We're talking about Laurence Olivier and Kenneth Branagh have already done this. In fact, they've done this story. And Orson Welles directed a movie about half of this film. So he's got some heavy shoes to fill here. And he does. He does. It's a familiar story. It's based off those Shakespeare plays called The Henriad, you know, the two Henry the Fourth, Henry the Fifth, and real life. They took some Henry V facts. This is the climax is about that battle everyone's kind of heard of, the Battle of Agincourt.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, you know, the first half of the film, he's this kid who doesn't want to be king because he hates his father, Henry IV, and he's the ne'er-do-well. He's the prodigal son. He's just getting drunk every night with Falstaff. King dies. Long live the king. Welcome, Henry V. And he's a different type of king. Henry IV he's a bad dude. He was only out for him. He was not nice to the people. He just started wars to start wars. Henry V wants peace. He's like, I'm not my father. I do not hate the people he hated. Let's start anew. But of course, France will not let him, and he has to go to war with France. And a very interesting choice of casting on purpose, because he wanted him to go far. The Dauphin, the Prince of France, is Robert Pattinson.
Edward from Twilight.
With this egregious, over-the-top, on-purpose French accent. Every stereotypical French accent, he uses it. It sounds like Pepe Le Pew. And he's got this really long, terrible blonde wig. And I think on purpose, he plays so goofy, over-the-top. Yeah, like he should be in a Monty Python film, is how he chose to play it. And when an actor does this, I said, well, the actor made choices. He was very brave. He made choice. I said the same thing.
He made a choice to do Twilight, which I'm perfectly okay with.
And that's fine. But, you know, he made choices the same way, like when I said Eddie Redmayne when he did Jupiter Ascending. He made choices. Right. I really liked it. It's a lot of people say, but it's dull. It's about history and it's dry. Well, welcome to Henry V, dude.
And that's why I just did not bother seeing it, is because as much as I love Timothy Chalamet, he's sort of the coming-of-age movie king, as it were, from, you know, that we saw in Call Me By Your Name and Lady Bird and Beautiful Boy. So this guy, this kid, now young man, is so versatile. And I do appreciate his acting. This was just one where the genre and the topic just did not have any appeal to me, even though I think it also has Joel Edgerton, and I really like Joel Edgerton. I think maybe he was a co-writer on this. But, you know, so again, it sounds like a really good cast. I just had zero interest in the topic.
Joel Edgerton does play Falstaff, and he does co-write it, and he produces alongside Brad Pitt, in fact.
And wasn't your girl from Jojo Rabbit in this as well?
Tamsin.
McKenzie.
Thomason McKenzie is in it. And Lily Rose Depp shows up at the end. Depp, yes.
Any relation?
A very close relation, in fact. And she blows her bit part out of the water. In fact, She was so good that her and Timothy are dating in real life now.
Wow.
There is a big battle, and it's so effective in showing warfare without technology and what that looks like. Braveheart was a little bit sensationalist, and yes, this is not Braveheart. There's only one battle in this film, not, you know, eight. Chainmail armor, how hard it is to fight and that stuff. It's nasty. Like, I'm glad I do not live in 1415.
So, will the Game of Thrones people who are going through some sense of withdrawal, is this something that they might gravitate towards?
No, because there's no dragons, and the dialogue's not as punchy, and there's no boobies. Okay. And
just checking.
It's a lot less action. I mean, this is a dialogue-heavy character arc from boy who wanted nothing to do with king, king who must go win war.
So it doesn't sound like it's not going to break through the award season.
It's not. It will in production design and score. I might actually put Timothy on my actor list. He's very good, as he always is, you
as
mentioned.
As he always is.
This will not resonate with people. No one's going to put this on their top five best films list. But I checked my tomato meter, as I always do. Out of all the films we're going to talk about this week, it has the best score, but only at 72.
Interesting.
Well, actually, I didn't check Harriet's score because we didn't see Harriet this week, but...
Okay.
It's got a 72%. Trust me, this film is really darn good.
All right. It's good. Well, I'll just take your word for it.
You know what's not as good as The King?
Yeah.
It's something we saw at the Middleburg Film Festival. We both walked out of here going,
disappointing.
Yeah, the movie's called Frankie. And talk about dialogue heavy. All the film is people walking around talking to each other for, you know, about an hour and a half. It's from Ira Sachs. I've seen his last two, Love is Strange and Little Men, both about the New York City housing market. Frankie is not about the New York City housing market.
Not
in fact, it takes place in a vacation resort town in Portugal. Frankie is Isabelle Huppert. You love Isabelle Huppert.
I love Isabelle Huppert.
What is going on with Frankie? Why are we in Portugal? And why is everybody talking their heads off?
Well, we talked a bit about this in our Middleburg Film Festival recap. So it's for those who didn't hear that, it's about Frankie is a actress who has a terminal illness, and she convenes like three generations of her family to this resort in Portugal for some reason. Basically, I don't know, maybe to sort of say her goodbyes or to just see all of her relatives have their family dynamic issues, but nothing happens in this movie. And that's what made it so disappointing, is that really good cast, but they don't interact much as a group. And so each individual storyline kind of takes place in its own few minutes, and they really don't intersect until maybe at the very end they're all on a mountaintop somewhere, and the movie is sort of like, that's it. And so it just, it really is, the ending signifies what the whole movie is, and that basically is not much.
There are pleasant parts to it, like when Huppert and Marissa Tomei have a scene, when Tomei and Greg Kinnear have a very funny scene.
Yes.
And the rest are other, they're so open-ended and so loose, and I'm pretty sure the director is saying something about, you know, look at the cycles of life. Here's one person going through first kiss. Here's one person going through first divorce. Here's one person going through first death. I don't know.
Yeah, and I get that. But boy, I just, you know, I just wanted to like it so much more. And I just can't really recommend it to anyone. I wish I could, because, again, really good cast. I love Greg Kinnear, Marissa Tomei, Isabelle Huppert. But it just... just kind of is. It's one of those films you just sit through, and then it ends, and you're just like, okay.
Now, the film we did not see this week is Harriet, and you've heard things about Harriet. Tell us what you've heard about Harriet.
I know that you hate for me to even talk about a film that we have yet to see, but the fact is that Harriet is one that we will indeed have to see before the Oscars and all the award season, you know, brouhaha starts really amping up, because what I have heard is that Cynthia Erivo, who plays Harriet Tubman in the biopic Harriet, is phenomenal. So everyone seems to agree on that, and there's every expectation that she will be nominated. But the buzz about the film overall is kind of lukewarm, and people have been kind of split. I think it employs some kind of narrative device involving visions that, you know, that Harriet felt that she was sent about her role in helping slaves get to freedom through the Underground Railroad. And so, you know, it's, everybody is really grateful that her story is finally really being told. She's a true American hero, heroine. She should be on the $20 bill by now. But, you know, I do think that because of what I have heard about this film, it is one that we will have to see, though I suspect other than being really impressed by Cynthia Erivo's performance, we may not be all that enamored with the film.
Fair enough. But we will, I promise, catch up on that.
And we definitely will.
One film I caught up with this week on Netflix, The Laundromat. It opened about a week or two ago on the service. And people are talking about The Laundromat because, well, A, it's a Steven Soderbergh film. We know Soderbergh. Aaron Brockovich, Traffic, Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Even earlier this year, he already did one for Netflix called High Flying Bird that I saw about basketball. The Laundromat is the big shot, but it's about the Panama Papers, if you remember when that story mm-hmm. blew up a couple years ago. It's a comedy. I mean, it's a dramedy, but it's funny. Meryl Streep's in it. It has a couple people. Antonio Banderas and Gary Oldman are there breaking the fourth wall, looking at us, saying, oh, this isn't right, but it's legal, and this is very complicated stuff, and it is. It's forgettable. I didn't care for it.
This is one where, other than having seen the initial trailers and being quite excited for it, and it being on those early lists of what you needed to see come Oscar time. It seems to be falling off those lists, and it just did not sustain any buzz at all. And so whereas there are some that you kind of go, oh, you got to go back and see this. Like, you know, hey, if you're going to watch something on Netflix, Dolomite is probably, you know, really the best bet right now to it go is. And catch up on.
Out of the three Netflix we just talked about, Dolomite's the best.
Right. And so Laundromat just keeps spinning further and further down the down the queue. And that always means that sometimes when we have so much good stuff coming down the pike, that it makes it really hard to catch up on these other ones. Whether or not, Meryl Streep will once again be a darling on the award circuit, I don't know.
I don't see it at all.
Yeah, it just depends. And we talked about this earlier with, even with Cynthia Erivo being kind of put out there, her name for Harriet. This is the time of year where we're starting to sort of get some of those screeners trickle our way to remind us of films from earlier in the year and performances that you just have to sort of go, oh, wait, you know, she's on my list. And so this week we got Us, and that reminded me by getting the For Your Consideration screener for Us absolutely reminded me of Lupita Nyong'o being very high on my list from earlier this year for a Best Actress nomination.
Lupita is still my number one by far. No, that came out like in March.
Yeah.
By far, she's number one with a bullet so far.
Yeah, so as we track what's what could still be in the mix for the award season, we'll try and remind people so that when we have to fill out those forms.
Scarlett Johansson from Marriage Story.
Mm-hmm.
Renee Zellweger.
Yeah, and Renee Zellweger, I mean, is still, she and Lupita are probably neck and neck right now for my best actress.
That aren't out yet, but people are talking about is Bombshell, specifically Charlize Theron.
Oh, right, right.
Little Women. Saoirse Ronan.
Huge cat. Huge.
From The Farewell, Awkwafina.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really, there's some.
In my personal dark horse from Midsommar, Florence Pugh.
And I have not seen Midsommar, and so we'll see if that might be one of those ones that's like, is it really worth catching up on? I don't know. It looks very weird. I suspect not. But no, it gets very interesting at this time of year to start trying to figure out who gets bumped off of those lists and who you make sure you keep on the list and try and give a little extra push towards.
All right, what are we looking at next week?
Well, next week we've got, you already saw Midway, so you'll be able to talk about that. Yep. Unfortunately, I think I'm going to be missing all those screenings, but I definitely plan to see Last Christmas, which
I will
looks
miss
like,
that, so you're alone.
That one looks like a ton of fun. I'm really looking forward to that. I am taking one for the team and going to see Playing with Fire with John Cena tomorrow. Ooh. Family film. Looks like one of those fun family films. Dr. Sleep is the... what you call it? It's supposed to be the, is it a sequel?
It is. It's the sequel to The Shining.
To The Shining. Okay. And that is one that is only playing at a time I cannot go. So I don't know if you're going to that one. And then there's the theatrical release of The Irishman, which I have yet to sit through the 3.5 hours for that one and don't know if I will. And then a couple maybe you and the kid can catch on Netflix. Apparently Green Eggs and Ham.
I haven't heard of that yet.
I know, but that's, and some other one called Klaus. So I don't know if we'll figure out what those are about by next week.
Is that Klaus or Claus?
I don't know. It could be Claus, maybe. I don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll see. Quick recap. We talked about Terminator. Dark Fate. It's a retread. I know that they always do that, but no, it does not need to exist.
I think it's okay that it exists. It's a little bit of nostalgia plus a little bit of what could come our way moving forward.
Motherless Brooklyn. No one's going to see it, but I'm glad to see film noir still here.
Catch it on a plane sometime when you're sort of like sifting through titles and you go, hey, it's Edward Norton, and he's always worth a watch.
The King's best film of the week. I really liked watching Timothée Chalamet succeed playing Henry V.
I can feel pretty confident that I would not consider The King to be the best film of the week for mainstream types like myself.
You don't know.
So I don't know, but we shall see. But I love Timothée Chalamet, but that would be my only reason really for seeing that one.
And the only reason anyone would ever want to see Frankie is Brendan Gleeson sex scene.
Which you'll have to go back and listen to our Middleburg wrap up for understanding that one a little more. But Frankie was just a disappointment.
And we promise we will see Harriet sometime.
Indeed.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Bucknell.
Thank you.
Take care.